Welcome to the Blue Collar Zen Podcast, recorded here at the Detroit Zen Center. Welcome back to the podcast. Today's story comes from the oral tradition of Zen and Buddhism, and it's called The Story of Fire and Weeds.
Once upon a time, at a small temple near a forest mountain, a young Zen nun named Yasi was meditating in the forest. Her parents had given her to the temple when she was a child, as they were too poor to support her. The elderly abbot became her teacher. His name was Madhava, an unremarkable monk, except for his very bright countenance. He spent his days doing menial tasks and spoke rarely, but with a boom. His Dharma talks were considered mundane, often focused on day-to-day life. Mountain life was rugged and hard, and the temple was quite poor. One day, an esteemed university professor traveled the long way up to the temple. He was a well-known Buddhist scholar who had come seeking teachings from the abbot Madhava, and so was invited in for tea. After their tea, the professor was leaving but came across the young nun Yasi weeding the garden in front of the kitchen. He called her over and began a conversation. At the end of their chat, he said, "Your teacher is very kind, but doesn't possess great Dharma insight. I suggest you find a great master if you are sincere about your study. Here, take this book." And he handed her the Avatamsaka Sutra and began his descent down the temple. Yasi had been with her teacher for several years. He had become her spiritual father, but it never occurred to her that her teacher might lack deep wisdom or that she should seek greater teachings. That night, she dove into the Avatamsaka Sutra, and the power of the sutra shook her to her core. It was rich, complex, and she now feared that she would never attain the great freedom of enlightenment if she stayed with her kind yet simple teacher. Rather than providing her with great Dharma teachings, her teacher spent most of their time together pointing out where she didn't pay attention, or telling her to put things away that she left around, always reminding her to be more careful. Just that morning, he had asked her to rake more deliberately. She found his daily appeals irritating, let alone impossible to follow. She tried her best to follow his guidance, but it didn't seem it would lead her anywhere special. She often felt anxious and unsure of herself, and now wondered if the problem, after all, was she simply needed deeper teachings. Over the next few weeks, she continued to read the Avatamsaka Sutra, and she began spending as much time as she could sitting in meditation in the cool morning forest, then reading there in the afternoons, and sitting again in the evenings. She contemplated impermanence and imagined the eventual demise and death of her own body, and the ever-changing nature of thoughts. But her mind was still filled with anxiety and general dissatisfaction. There was still so much Yasi did not understand, and her teacher refused to explain. Such things as how did this world and our consciousness come about in the first place? She wondered aloud. Was it created at a single point in time, or does the world have no beginning? What is the nature of awakening that we seek? What happens to an awakened person when they die? Yasi could not wait anymore. She got up and rushed to her teacher's room. She opened the door without knocking and said, "If you won't or can't answer my questions, the honest thing to do is admit it and let me leave your training so I can find a better teacher. Please don't hold back anything from me." Madhava kept silent for a long time. Finally, he began to speak.
"Yasi, I'm going to be honest with you. You remind me of a story that has been passed down in our tradition for a long, long time. The Buddha himself shared this story. Please listen carefully and pay attention. A house caught fire, and the entire family was inside sleeping. As the smoke seeped in through the windows and under the doors, the mother woke up, shook her husband, and began shouting, 'Fire! Fire!' and ran through the house screaming, helping her three children get out of bed and outside as quickly as possible. Now outside, she realized her husband was still in the house. She ran back in shouting, 'Husband, where are you?' She found her husband standing in the living room, inspecting the situation. He stared at her and yelled, 'I'm getting to the bottom of this. I need to know how this fire started. Why this is happening to me. I need to get this furniture and other belongings out before we lose it all.' Meanwhile, the flames creeped closer and thick smoke filled the air. The wife, choking, cried and begged her husband, 'Get out, please, come out. You're going to die in here,' and tried to drag him by the arm. Yasi, as you can imagine, the man will die if he goes on this way. Whether his questions could be answered or not, they are not relevant. And meanwhile, his life is at risk. Attachment to this worldly possessions would certainly kill him as well. Your questions remind me of this man. Answering them will not help you. I have explained what you need to do to wake up from delusion. Please don't hesitate. Time is short, and life waits for no one. Freedom comes from your own mind and nowhere else. Now leave my room and get back to your business.' Yasi walked over toward the monastery kitchen, with tears of relief and gratitude filling her eyes. She spotted her Dharma elder brother working in the kitchen. He smiled at her. In front of the kitchen was the vegetable garden, and she was its caretaker. She had foregone weeding the vegetable garden in favor of spending most of the work days meditating in the woods, so the weeds were thick and tall and completely overgrown. The afternoon sun streamed through, casting a vivid glow along the garden. Her teacher and elder brother monk hadn't even mentioned the weeds.
I have a couple more hours of sunlight to weed this garden before bedtime, she thought. As the sun set that evening, she experienced the truth of her teacher's words and vowed to find freedom within her own mind in the life that was unfolding moment by moment.
Sonam, what a great story.
You liked that one, did you?
Yeah. That one certainly hits close to home. What did you think about that story, Sonam?
Well, I think it's more important what you think about that story.
Mm.
I actually told it.
Right. Yeah, I think I really relate to that story, and how often I've thought to myself over the years, man, there's got to be something other than my current life that would be sort of like the missing link or the missing piece to my
something special
that would be the missing piece to my satisfaction or spiritual freedom. Yeah. And then that's just never the case. So how great that she got that teaching at a young age.
Well, and I think that it's a really strong trap to be looking for something special.
Yeah.
Because your life is so important. And I think a realization that happens along the way in Zen training is that the day that you come to grips with, you're not really special.
Yeah.
And in one sense, it may sound a little bit strange. You actually become special by not thinking you're special or trying to do something that's special.
Yeah.
And just living a day-to-day with the same kind of routine that many, many people go through, but they do the routine wanting to get someplace else.
Right.
Over and over again, they're lamenting about not getting somewhere, and they're just not even in their own body in that sense.
Right.
And that's, to the degree I did that in my own training, it's lamentable to me, like,
yeah,
oh my God. But it's a very common, I think, and I would call it like a disease or a dis-ease with what your current life represents.
Yeah. Yeah, you've often shared with me in my own study, you know, with you, that you'll see, oh, Myungju, you know, you're really good at paying attention and being really careful when around things that so-called matter.
That you think that is important.
That I think are important.
Yeah.
But then, you know, menial tasks, you know, things can kind of, you can sort of see the holes. And when I examine that in my own life, I realize, wow, every moment, and I mean, this is going to sound really, you know, cheesy, but like every moment is a bloody miracle. So why, like how, it's clearly my mistake when I'm not relating to that, whether it's time to, you know, use the bathroom or wash the dishes or, yeah, weed the garden or write a huge grant. I mean, they're all just moments of my life, and I'm always sort of right there at the center of that. So I guess I wonder, maybe this is kind of like Yasi's questions, they're not worth asking, but I do wonder why we're tricked that way. Like, how is it that we lose the ability to be aware? Like, here we are in the UP, we're surrounded by deer and wildlife and birds and hawks, and they're always in the moment. They're always so fully embodied, and that's what's so beautiful about them. The trees, So why is it that humans sort of suffer from this condition of, you could call it a kind of an apathy or a dissatisfaction with life? Why do we have that, Sunim? Does that even matter?
Well, I think, first of all, we have it because we're the only creature that can think about it in the way you just described.
Like a kind of self-reflection.
Yeah. And the other thing I want to say about each moment is an expedient. There's only the moment. It doesn't come and go.
Like a perpetual moment is what are you saying?
Well, it's time, isn't it?
Yeah. Right.
The time is now.
Right.
And even saying now is just an expedient. It just is as it is.
Right.
And the moment we're living in that world, we're following the Tao.
Yeah.
Without even having to think about it.
Yeah.
Because the moment you think about it, you leave the Tao behind.
Right.
That's really important to realize.
It sounds like you're saying there's nothing to worry about except what's in front of you.
Well, how did Matsu say, become a person without concerns?
Right.
He's one of the great Zen teachers in our lineage.
If it's so simple, then why is it so difficult for people to do?
Well, we've already talked about it because of the whole idea that you could be brought up, your parents telling you how special you are. You maybe you're the smartest in class or the best athlete or the best musician. People always telling you you have special talents. You're better than
or maybe the converse, that you don't have those talents and there's something wrong with you because you know, I think a lot of people get that kind of negative feedback too, that, you know, they have to become, you know, they better watch out if they don't figure out what makes them special.
But I think those are the people that tend to be, I guess you could say, think of themselves as failing individuals and never look forward.
Right.
Somebody that really is in fact special. This is, you know, in terms of being smart or being a musician, this is important to recognize that you have this kind of talent, but it's nothing special. It's just something that is part of the unfolding of the cosmos, and it always comes down to how you utilize that. And if you turn it into trying to become something special with it, well, I don't think it ends very well.
Yeah.
Because there's no special ending to dying.
Right.
Right. There's no satisfaction unless you have literally transcended the human world. No matter how much your individual accomplishments are there, it's not going to help you in that final stage.
Yeah.
The only thing that's going to help is the work that you've done on yourself to realize all of this is just grist for the mill, not something to lay a claim to.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, something that you've often said to me and that I've heard from other teachers, or have other teachings I've received, very kind of similar teaching, is that, you know, you have to kind of take it easy. Not in the sense that you become lazy or, you know, don't do your work, but I guess in my own experience as a young American kid, I think I definitely fell into that trap of wanting to be special. And in a sense, I think wanting to become special even, it kind of launched me onto the Zen Buddhist path because it seemed like the most special path, you know, the path of enlightenment. It's like, oh my gosh. And But as I got into it, a common refrain from you and my other experience with teachers is that they've kind of pointed to, you know, kind of like, take it easy. And I, well, what I now see about that is it's like you have to really be careful not to approach your life, your so-called spiritual life, with a sense of desire or aggression, you know, like wanting to get something out of it. It's like you really have to learn how to enjoy this life. And I really struggle with that still. It's kind of like, I'll, you know, find myself walking down to the lake here. It's a beautiful place. There's nothing to do except just enjoy this beauty. But yet I'll still find myself in some kind of a subtle way, a little dissatisfied, you know, a little like my mind's kind of like, well, I don't know, maybe I should skip rocks or should I go swimming? It's like a really, it's very subtle, but it seems like there's always a barrier between myself and the world around me. And it's, you know, other than certain moments where that dissolves, I wonder if you could speak to, you know, your own experience in life. And does that eventually just sort of dissolve completely?
Okay, there is no barrier.
Right.
Right. And you can only think there's a barrier.
Right. Yeah.
So but you ask another question that I think needs to be, I guess in this case, I think I've said this to you before, so I want to remind you again.
Okay.
Because you're somebody that has played, say, the guitar, and you have. You play the guitar very well. And when you're talking about the fact that you're chasing something special, it would be akin to, in terms of a metaphor, of tightening the strings on the guitar too much to try to get a better sound out of them,
right,
with the risk that you could actually break the strings. Now, you need a taut string. If it's loose, you also can't use it.
Right.
It's got to be just right. And I think
right.
This is true of our life. So
right.
It's got to be just right. So when you find yourself thinking about, in a sense, what more you have to do while you're doing what you're doing, you just need to bring yourself back to that over and over again, to what you're doing.
It's almost like you're comparing the mind to an instrument. I mean, the sort of day-to-day mind.
Well, in that sense, isn't it our most profound instrument?
Yeah, right.
It does. We yeah. can't be without it,
yeah.
But we have very little understanding. Or understanding might not be the right word, because psychology has been trying to understand it.
Yeah.
But directly experiencing the mind as it is.
Yeah.
The teaching is that mind is Buddha, Buddha is mind. You cannot find a Buddha or awakening outside of your own mind. That's pretty profound teaching.
Well, and just, that's interesting. So what that brings up for me is this idea that, you know, if you want to learn how to play the guitar or you want to become a musician or an athlete, you know, you have to spend time cultivating that, I don't know if you'd call it just technique, but you just have to spend time with the instrument. You know, you have to get to know it, and or in a sports situation, you have to get to know your teammates, and you know, you have to practice.
But there's a difference in terms of that, in trying to get good overnight.
Right.
In other words, throw out all patience and go to the extreme, and that's kind of what we're talking about.
Right.
Wanting to become
special.
Something different than you are.
Well, what I was going to share or point out is that it seems like in the fast-paced, you know, world that we're, most of us are living in now, there's very little time to actually spend with your mind. It's always filled. Your time is always filled. And even when you have time to yourself, now the preoccupation becomes just pick up the phone and, you know, text someone or check emails. I sort of see this wasting situation where people, you know, if you want to get familiar with your mind and how to work with it, you actually have to spend time with it.
Well, that's where I think the Zen has established the ways of to work with your mind. And to not be elaborate about it in a podcast like this. It's a sense of deep questioning, and that question that's always behind whatever it is you're doing.
Yeah.
Who's doing it?
Right.
Right? So you can just be doing the task mindlessly, or you can be doing it asking who's doing it. But you still get the task done.
Yeah.
It's just that now you're coming from the point of view of really trying to discover what this is, who this is, that's doing everything, that's sleeping, that's eating, that's doing all of the normal things. That's still working with your mind.
Yeah.
You brought that up, like, well, if you start doing something, you're still working with your mind.
So I
but
guess,
if you forget
yeah.
who's behind that, so, like
yeah.
there's the mind isn't some kind of a thing that you can describe with color or shape or smell or touch, but it's the driving force of every single thing we do, even when it's ignorant things.
So I guess I'm totally off there in that comment, because in my mind I was setting up, well, you need to carve out time to work with your mind, but I guess what you're saying there is, well, no, you're always working with your mind, whether
yes.
you're aware of it or not.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
See how easy it is to lose the truth? I really relate to Yasi Sunim. Yeah, that story is really something. I mean, it's kind of hard to imagine a guy in a house like it's on fire, there's flames, the smoke is everywhere.
Well, don't take it so literally. Just imagine all of the things that you tell yourself
right.
before you actually do what is in your heart to do.
Well, that's what I was going
to
say.
So if people come to the yeah. Zen Center, for example, and tell mm-hmm. you, I think so deeply of the Zen Center, and I really want to practice here, and then you don't see them for, who knows, it might be
right.
days, weeks, months, or years,
right.
and they come back and tell you the same kind of thing, or, oh, I wish I would have just started 5 years ago, or
right.
5 months ago, but when you examine it, you begin to see, just like that man, they've put all these things in place that they've got to do before they get to the Zen Center, before they get to their spiritual life.
Yeah.
Instead of realizing you make your life your spiritual life,
right.
but that's the basis of what you do. And learning how to do that is one of the reasons you come to a Zen Center
right.
and any other spiritual place. I don't think there's any religion that doesn't want you to put the teaching into your day-to-day living.
Well, and I think on closer inspection of the story, it isn't as far-fetched, because it sounds a little preposterous. Oh, boy, you know, really, would a guy stay in there? But on closer inspection, that's exactly what's going on. I mean, you've said before, and this is a pretty common teaching, that every moment you breathe out, you know, you're continuing to burn. Your life is perpetually burning down every moment.
There's only so many breaths.
Yeah, there's some, and so it is happening. It's just it's a bit, there's more of a time lapse, so to speak, than being inside of a burning house. You know, we can't literally maybe see the flames or smell the smoke.
My Ansa Sunim used to say to us, your house is on fire, meaning this body, mind, that's what's on fire.
Right.
And using these metaphors to describe it shouldn't distract the idea that this is burning down at all times. From
yeah.
the moment you're born, you start down.
Well, and we seem to have have made our, you know, in a sense, the religion of the West is figuring out more and more ways to kind of just not only distract ourselves from that, but also just to feel better about it, to kind of cope with it, whether it's taking, you know, for anxiety or, you know, attention deficit disorders. I mean, you know, it's like basically if you've got some kind of a problem working with your mind, there is a drug for that, whether it's depression or, you know, ADHD. And not that those pills aren't needed in some cases, but they just seem to be sort of like that's the go-to now. Or if you're feeling sad, you know, eat something rich that will, you know, calm you down and make you just feel a little better because you get the dopamine hit, drugs, alcohol, all of it.
I don't want people to think, though, that listen to a podcast like this, that we're attempting to be critical of what others are doing. And I think if you stick with looking at your own situation and recognizing that each of us has to do what's necessary in order to allow us to do our life's work. And sometimes that means relaxation. Sometimes that means
I guess I just feel bad taking life
a little easier and not putting the pressure on your life, because that becomes worse. And it's also another disease of Zen students who are trying to get there fast.
I think I just worry about the fact that it's been monetized and people seem to be getting taken advantage of by corporations or pharmaceutical companies. It's kind of like they know people want to relax, and so they kind of, you know, what do we do to sort of, I don't know, to sort of support that sort of predatory system as Zen monks in America? How do you support people who are being sort of taken advantage of at this level? We all have this vulnerability, you know. How do we support people better, Sunam?
Well, I think that the best idea in terms is to help ourselves to the maximum. And then on top of that, if there's something that we can eat or take that would add to that, but to exclusively identify something outside of ourselves that's going to help us more than we're capable of helping ourselves.
So are you saying kind of rather than worrying about how to help others directly, you know, take care of your own business, and that will inadvertently be a way to help other people?
Well, of course. I mean, if you have, you don't become a Zen teacher other than based on your own experience.
Right.
What else could you teach? I can't teach Shakyamuni's life. I can teach only the life I'm living.
Right.
And to me, that is so incredibly relevant because we know all the pitfalls because we've been in them.
Yeah.
We've been in all those places that people are talking about, but they often try to set us up like, oh, they don't know about that. Try me.
Right.
Like, that's just not the case.
Yeah.
But we didn't let those kinds of things stop us from fulfilling what we deem the basis of our life.
Right.
And it doesn't mean to become a monk or a nun necessarily, but it means the basis of your life is your spiritual life.
Right.
And that's got to be reflected in what you do.
Right.
So whether it's a bus driver or a doctor, they can all be Buddhas.
Right.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and that seems related to the sort of thrust of the previous podcast. And one of the, again, it seems like as I get older, I start remembering the things you used to teach very early on. You used to always say, if you want to end war in the world, you have to start by ending the war within your own mind.
Isn't that true?
Yeah. And we rode the bus into Ontonagon the other day. We were picked up by this gentleman. You know, they have this service in Ontonagon. And it was great.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it doesn't take some dramatic thing,
right,
but just a kind person or two kind people talking about the weather that day or what's going to happen.
Just an uplifting kind
in front of us.
Yeah, very warm. Yeah. Okay, Sunam, thank you. I see you're leaving the tea table. This podcast has ended.
You're almost ready to have a meeting.